Hey, it's Coach Sarah, and welcome to Range of Change, the podcast where we dive into the pivotal moments of transformation that shape our lives. If you're looking for inspiration, insights, and real talk about navigating change, big or small, you found the right place. I'm an ICF-certified coach and a seasoned change manager with 2 decades of experience helping people and organizations thrive through life's hairy moments. Whether you're choosing to make a bold leap into a new chapter of your life, or life is choosing it for you, this community will explore how to not just survive, but thrive through change. Think of this podcast as your guide to becoming more resilient, more empowered, and ready to take on your next big change with confidence. So welcome to the show, Erica. Thank you so much for joining me today. I know that we tried to connect in person. You are not the only person that I had to reschedule thanks to the great flu of January 2025, and it's wreaking havoc on households all over America.
That is for sure. Having somebody down in the house is no fun.
Absolutely. The first question I ask all of my guests, just to sort of level set, is, in general, how do you feel about change? On a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being fear, loathing, I hate it, and 10 being energized, excited, I love it.
I'm probably in the middle, to be honest, and I wonder if that surprises you.
A little bit.
Yeah, I think I love it when it's mine, you know, when it's my idea, when it's my invention, when it's my innovation, when it's the thing I want to do. I'm probably less so warm to change when somebody else is asking me to do it.
Okay. All right. That definitely tracks with what I know about you. But you are a change manager and expert in change. So I wonder if you feel that you have an advantage when you come into those moments of resistance. Or if you're just like everybody else at first and just, you know, sort of kicking your feet.
Yeah, I think I do have an advantage, but I want to admit that I think it's taken me a long time to capitalize on the advantage. Now, I've been in the space of change for a long time, and it's not until I really wrestled and understood the fact that it is not the change itself that is hard. It is how you respond to the change that makes the situation hard, and owning that. And so now I think that is my secret weapon, right? And just accepting this is what it is. How do I make the best of what this is? And the more time that I spend resisting it, being uncomfortable with the change, being saddened sometimes by the change, the more I'm preventing myself from moving forward in a good way. And so that is on me, and I own that. But it took a long time of change management practitionership, I think, to get there for myself.
Yeah, it's a really interesting idea because, you know, the change being hard is outside of our control. And to a degree, how we react, at least initially, is outside of our control too. There's a lot of just like that primitive brain structure that's just in reaction mode, threat mode, fear mode. But yeah, your ability to move beyond that is really where you can take power in any of those situations.
Yeah. And how long you allow yourself to stay in that primitive mode. And I love that you raise it because I think it's so important. We're human. You have to be human. It's okay to be sad, unhappy, disappointed with the change and sit with that. But it's how long you sit with that that matters.
It's an amazing perspective. And I find, you know, it makes me immediately think of the reason that I wanted to invite you on the podcast. And one of the significant moments of change in your life was a pretty dramatic and, as I recall the story, fast change that you made. You made a huge life change really quickly. And I'd love to hear more about your decision way back when to move to a purely plant-based diet.
Yeah, this was a long time ago now. It was 2016. It's funny, when people ask me how long have I been vegan, like 4 or 5 years tends to come to mind, but that's not true anymore. It was 2016. Yes. And so interestingly enough, I was a vegetarian at the time, and I had been for quite some time eating all the dairy and eggs I could, to be honest with you. Sure. Yeah. One of my relatives went through what I felt was, it was for me life altering. I'm sure it was for them too, but you know, being a caretaker in that situation was life altering to me. And that scenario was a triple bypass. So I don't know if you've ever been around any relative or been in the hospital or cared for somebody who's gone through a bypass surgery, but I was there the day of surgery and the week of the ICU treatment and recovery phase. And it was probably the most extreme thing I've seen. And it was the first time in my life that I had seen somebody on life support and seen the process of coming off life support, you know, thankfully to a good, healthy outcome. And that day, you know, really wrestling with, well, what is a bypass? You know, you hear that, but what is it? What happens? Yeah. Right? And the fact that your chest is cracked open and arteries are taken off your heart and veins are harvested from other parts of your body and reattached, you know, I mean, it's very scary. It's a very extreme thing. And in that moment, I started to do a ton of research around how do I help make this relative healthy for the rest of his days? And what does diet and nutrition look like from here on out, right, with this major change for them? And what I learned in that moment is if you're vegetarian from a saturated fat, cholesterol, heart health perspective, you're really not that much healthier than being a meat eater. And this was kind of shocking to me. And I knew seeing my relative in the hospital with this, a bypass of any sort was something I wanted to check off my bucket list. This was not going on the bucket list. This was a situation, a scenario I wanted to avoid for myself. And honestly, I wanted to avoid it for my family. I had two young kids at the time and just wanted to set up a different pattern of eating. And so the research just plowed into the research, and it really started that week in that moment with that scenario in my life.
Wow. So I'm really struck by, first of all, how you took a moment of trauma and, you know, just personal unease, and were able to look into the future with it, which is a very difficult thing to do. I mean, I think at any time it's difficult to put yourself literally in someone else's shoes into your own future decades down the line, but you did that, which is a powerful way, I think, to honor the love that you have for that person and really try to take this awful moment they have and turn it into something quite positive. And the other thing that strikes me is the research, because as someone who grew up as a woman in this society, I feel like studying diet and nutrition is like our second job since we're teenagers. Like, I always thought that I knew so much about nutrition. I've very recently started working with a registered dietitian, and my mind's been blown by how much I don't understand. And that became clear to me with my own experiment into veganism, that I just was not prepared. I would have needed to do a lot more work that it sounds like you did up front. How did you get yourself prepared to accept that you don't know what you don't know and really be open-minded in a way that is very challenging for people?
Oh yeah. And you want to know what I think the hardest part is about the research is, like, I made this decision kind of cold turkey. Like, I'm not going to end up in this hospital room hooked up to life support at some point in time in my life, right? And be in the ICU. I don't want to do this. The thing is cooking. How do you learn how to make dinner? Because I don't know about you, but for me growing up in my household, well, I think I had the luxury. Both my parents are incredible cooks. Like, holy cow, my parents cook. Right? Like, I've never met the bar that they set on cooking, let's be honest. And I still haven't. But because I grew up in a house with two parents who were really great cooks and really put on good meals, like including breakfast, you know, like three really great meals a day, you know, I had a repertoire of things that I knew how to make. No recipe, no looking up. I could say, I could, you know, go to the grocery store on a weekend in my head, go, okay, we're going to have these things, know what those ingredients are. And I could do things very seamlessly, like an almost in a robotic way. Right. And so turning this off and going, I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to eat these foods anymore. How are we going to eat? And this wasn't, I wasn't even in a place, Sarah, of substitutions, which can be easier because nowadays, and even back in 2016, there's egg replacers and, you know, there's soy and oat and rice milk instead of dairy. Like there's, so you just think, I'll just make my same recipes, but I'll just substitute. And that didn't work for me because I didn't go vegan per se. I went whole food plant-based, which means I wasn't eating mock meats, mock cheeses. So I went so extreme that I had to learn how to make seitan and do things with tofu and make homemade cheeses from scratch out of cashews and things. And so, yeah, I mean, it was the biggest learning for me was how do I cook? And let me tell you, Sarah, this was hard. And what I was doing was going in multiple places and finding multiple recipes, and it was a chore. It was a chore, but I was so committed. And so like, there was no going back. There was never going to be a cheat day. There was never going to be, okay, we'll be plant-based on Mondays and vegetarian the other 6 days. There was none of that. This was a cold turkey switch, and I was dedicated, and I would have eaten nothing versus eating something that was a cheat, right? And ultimately what I learned was we've got to lean, it takes a partner. To make change successful, I can't think of a time when I've been able to make a change successful that I didn't have at least a single partner helping me. And that partner for me was finding a woman named Molly Patrick, who has a service called Clean Food Dirty Girl. And every week she would have a recipe, like she had a week of recipes, and that would, you could customize it to how many people you're feeding, and you put your grocery list together. And on Sundays, I would batch cook. And I was so bad at it the first Sunday that I batch cooked. It took me 8 hours.
Oh my gosh.
And I thought, how can I do that? Like, I can't batch cook for 8 hours. And now I've gotten good at it, right? And we can do it in like two and a half hours, right? So significant efficiency. But it was time and practice to be able to do this.
Well, absolutely. And I'm curious about the commitment, because when you're in that moment of trauma, it's very easy to say, when you wake up hungover on New Year's Day, it's easy to say, I'm never drinking again.
Dry January starts today. Yes,
exactly. And I think that obviously this is far more traumatic than a hangover, but I would also imagine that for a lot of people, they have made a very emotional commitment like this. And at some point, the challenge is 8 hours of batch cooking, having to give up family recipes, which is its own emotional loss. You know, food is so central to everything we do. How did you contain, like, where did those reserves come from that allowed you to stay committed through the early challenges and other ones that I'm sure you encountered?
I'd love to say that it was just like a personal commitment to myself, because isn't that the best reason to make change? Because you're so invested in you and you so love you that you are doing this for you. And I think there was definitely an element of that, but I think it was more so my kids. Because what I knew from being in change was that habits and rituals are everything. That is the name of the game. If you're not changing habits and rituals, you are not actually changing. And this was my moment to take just a handful of years that they were on this earth, because they were very little back then, but change habits and rituals for them for life. And I was so dedicated to that cause that there was just like no giving up. And so I think it was me, like I certainly didn't want to end up on the operating table with a triple bypass, but I wanted the possibility of that for my kids to be just nil, right? To have captured their eating habits and preferences so early in life and undone any damage I had done in the years that they had been, you know, here.
Sure.
And that's what kept me going.
That's really powerful. And it's so relatable. I mean, everyone wants to do what's best for their kids. I'm curious if your kids have ever had a stage of rebellion. Have they gone to a friend's house and they had pizza or cakes or, I don't know, something that caused them to question what you were doing for them?
Yeah, so I think I have this conversation with my kids all the time, right? Because I certainly don't want food to be punishing, right? And sometimes I have we have this saying in our family, like when we're out and about or we're traveling, right? We're not home, we're not in our safety net of restaurants where we know to go and eat. I will always say we're vegan at home, but it's okay to be vegetarian on the streets if we've got to be. So I think if you asked my daughter, she would probably want to be vegetarian, but we'll always pick the vegan thing when we're out if it's available. My son has absolutely eaten meat behind my back, and he's done it recently, and it's never behind my back. We don't have that kind of relationship. It's open. Sure. We can talk about it. Interestingly enough, I don't know what happened, but he did spend the night at a friend's house recently, and they probably didn't know we were plant-based, and he's the type of kiddo who would never want to be an inconvenience to anybody else. And so if they're cooking dinner or they're ordering out and this is what they've ordered, this is what I'm eating, and it's just being respectful. So he did eat meat at their house, and then in the middle of the night woke up throwing up and threw up several times and came home and was sick the whole next day. Now, was that from eating meat or was that just coincidental? I don't know, but it left a lasting impression on him for sure.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I love that approach because obviously you've given them a gift, like you said, of their nutritional tastes and this foundation of solid health, but obviously you're instilling critical thinking and the ability to be curious and thoughtful about this as they approach their life. So I can see how that is a really strong why in terms of what keeps you anchored, or at least in the early days.
Yes. Yes. You know, we're also in this house. We've got three cats roaming around our house who we love very much. And so we do have also not just nutrition conversations, but we do have ethical conversations in the house too. Like, is a dog or a cat different than a cow or a pig? They're not, right? And how would you feel if you heard about somebody eating a dog or a cat? You know, in our culture, you would find that to be quite odd, right? And you would probably cast a bit of judgment around that. And so why isn't the same level of judgment cast around other animals, right? And so we do have those conversations too. I think my daughter is a real animal lover. There was a point in time in her even younger youth that being a veterinarian was on the list of things I might want to be when I grew up, you know? And so she will say, yeah, it's weird to me that we would, you know, torture animals, murder animals, eat animals. I don't know that my son has quite made that leap, but we talk about it from all the different angles.
Yeah. I mean, that's amazing because it is so complex. And I think that anytime that we're trying to instill values in our kids, there's, you know, the values we have, and we ideally want them to have those values. So it's that really extra layer of difficulty to give them the skills to question and challenge and really forge their own path.
Yes. And ultimately, you know, I feel like when my kids are 18, maybe not 18, and the reason why I say maybe not 18 is because when they're in college, if they're still being funded by me, they're still mine, you know, okay, probably when they're 18, you know, the decision is theirs. You know, my house will always be a plant-based house, but ultimately, you know, they become their own people and the decision will be theirs. I will just feel good that if they end up with heart disease later in life, it's not because something I did while they were living in my house.
Right. Yeah. So as I alluded to earlier, and as you know, I became very motivated to transition to a plant-based diet like last year at this time. And in my own hubris, I thought that I understood nutrition better than I do. And I was definitely taking a substitution approach. We're all very busy. I did not think that I had the time, nor did I think I needed to do this evolution of how I ate and batch cooking and everything that you've described that really set you up for success from a nutrition standpoint. And because I didn't research it or plan for it or do it particularly well. I did not get the results I was hoping for.
Shocking!
I know, who'd have thunk it? So I think there's like a temptation where some people would hear that and say, oh, well, veganism's not that healthy because, you know, your numbers didn't go in the direction you wanted to. And it's like, well, any diet where you don't eat the most nutritious food is not going to be healthy. Like, I'm sure there's a way to go to the Mediterranean diet and eat nothing but like fried shrimp and not do well for yourself. So all of that is a question to say, if somebody is feeling compelled to try a different diet for nutrition reasons or moral reasons or ecological reasons, I mean, there's a lot of compelling reasons that someone might want to go plant-based. How would you suggest if they are not you and say, I'm doing it, and then do it.
Just do it.
What recommendations do you have to increase the likelihood of success?
So I think I have a pattern that I would use for making this type of change or any change. And that is, just like you said, the reason. You've got to start there. You've got to have that compelling reason that speaks to you and that inherently motivates you. Then you have to understand, what is your role in making this change? What are you accountable to for yourself, for your household? Like for me, this was a household change that I made, right? It wasn't just for me. I was like, I was doing this for me, but I'm doing it. We're all making this change together. So what is your reason? What is your role? And really understanding, what is your accountability to yourself and others as you make this change? What is the path that I need to go on? And that is all the research that I need to do. Like, what is the path of travel to get me from here to there? And what does that transition state look like? And that path of travel includes the knowledge, skills, and abilities that you need to be able to successfully go from where you are today to where you need to go. And the last is partnership. Again, like, I don't think it's easy to make change without at least one partner, whether that's an accountability partner, that's somebody doing it with you, that's somebody coaching you. And in my mind, I think change is most successful when you have a variety of partners, right? So for me, I was going through this with my family, right? We are going to do this because we are not going to have this health outcome. I do not want to have these habits. You know, I want to have different habits and rituals in the house. And so they were partners, but I also enlisted Molly Patrick, right? She didn't know it. We did it in a virtual way, right? But she taught me how to cook, you know? And so I needed a variety of people to support me. And that coaching that I got from Molly, which again, she didn't know she was giving it to me, but it wasn't just an email that I got from her with, here are the recipes for the week. There was an online active Facebook community. She had her employees who would Facebook Live every Sunday on batch day, and you could batch right along with them or check in and see how they were doing on their batch. It was a community. It truly was a community. So that partnership and community that I got from this group was huge. So it's your reason, your role, your path, and your partner. And anytime you have a change, you've got to understand what those four things are for you, I think.
I think that's amazing. I mean, I can't emphasize the role of community enough, especially as we have, we lose it. We've been losing it for decades. I mean, let's be honest. I think throughout our lifetime, we did not have the community that our parents or our grandparents had. But certainly since the pandemic, it has just become crisis level. I mean, there people are so fractured. We have such an ability to be entirely alone, to play alone, to think alone, to, you know, be sad alone. Like, these used to be moments that brought people together. But I also love the idea that, you know, you did a lot yourself. Like, you focused on your role, but you didn't need to have every role. So, you know, you did not have to go out there and figure out how to cook, what the recipes were, how to balance your nutritional needs. Like, you outsourced that. And in doing so, you found a community of people that were all leaning on this one amazing woman and were able to support one another. It's so powerful.
It really was. And that was the turning point, right? Finding her was the turning point from, I'm committed and I'm doing this and I'm not going back and I'm not giving up, but this is hard, to, this is easy and I can do this. Right? That she was the one.
Yeah. And that's the amazing moment. Like, that's the moment everyone wants to get to, regardless of what that new habit is, whether it's a habit, I'm going to exercise every day, or it's a series of habits like you're describing, because this lifestyle change touches so many different parts of your life. But there was a moment where you transitioned from being overwhelmed to being empowered.
Absolutely. Right. And you've got to find that unlock, right? And that unlock just clears the path for it to be a sustainable change.
Yeah. So sustainability, I think that's a great topic to transition to now. You know, you get to the point where you are locked into your why, you have a routine, you're feeling empowered, you have figured it out. What does your sustainment and reinforcement look like? Is it the same? I mean, I imagine you're still working with Molly's recipes, but are there elements that you bring in that are new that allow you to maintain that commitment over the long term?
Yeah. And I think I'm lucky in this change. For me, it is also health related, right? And so I'm a cholesterol absorber. Yay, I've inherited that. And so even in this, the thing that helps me sustain is I have my blood work done once a quarter. And so I know the things that truly work for me. And the things that really work for me are eating as raw as I possibly can, right? So that's smoothies, fresh juicing, salads that really just have raw, fresh fruits, veggies, nuts, seeds on them, making my own salad dressings and keeping things really low fat. And I do know that when I move into a still what would be considered for anybody, you would think a healthy plant-based, whole food plant-based diet, I know that when I do tofu 5 days a week, because that's higher in fat and higher in protein, the numbers start getting worse. And so I've learned for me, you know, we have a lot of focus these days on protein, 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 protein. And when I do that, my cholesterol goes up and my glucose goes up. And, you know, over a 90-day period, my A1C will go up. And so I know that those things don't work for me. What I really need to do is just eat as much raw fruits and veggies as I can. And then my numbers are perfect. And so that quarterly blood work check is a phenomenal. I mean, that's my measure, right? That is having a measure in place and knowing what does that tell me? And how do I respond based on what that blood work says every quarter?
That's amazing. Cause I hadn't, you know, I think of a yearly physical. So I think of, you know, if I were to break this into chunks, I have years. I love the idea of thinking of quarters and having that ability to hack what you're doing. So it's so much easier to wrap your head around a quarter, to track for a quarter, to make this the quarter where I cut out tofu or, you know, adjust, you know, my protein intake and see what happens with that. I'd love that idea.
Yes. Yes. And it's hard. And I'll tell you, sometimes those results are hard because, man, I love cooked food. Like cooked food is so dang good. You know, it's fantastic. Yeah. You know, and I live in the South. And so it's like warm here a lot, but don't get me wrong. Like we sure as hell do get 3 months of cold winter weather here. And who doesn't love like a great hot soup or stew, right? Or warm food. Like when it's cold out, like it's so great, especially to have warm food. And so that has not, it's not always been easy, right? And so I have definitely had those quarters where it's like, yep, it's been a cooked food, tofu eating quarter. Or like seitan, that's the other thing too. Like I love seitan. I don't know if you've ever made your own homemade seitan, but if you haven't made your own homemade seitan, oh my gosh, seitan is so great. It is super high in protein. And so I might love it and it might be absolutely delicious to me, but if I'm eating that, you know, a tofu scramble every morning for breakfast and some seitan at dinner time, I'm going to tank. And so sometimes it's not always easy to be like, yep, I just got to focus on those raw foods, especially when it's January and it's gloomy and all I want to do is have a cup of soup.
I completely get that. You're going to have to share a seitan recipe. Like I'm going to have, there's no way we're getting out of this without letting people make their own seitan and see for themselves.
So good.
Yes. I eat it frequently. I've never made my own. But yeah, that's exactly the, I think the kind of information that would allow me as I build towards my next absolutely going to be successful attempt at this. These are the skills I need to have and have a good benchmark of what it looks like to make a batch of seitan.
Yes. I should be your partner in this next quarter.
Absolutely. Like you don't have enough going on. Oh my goodness. All right. So as we wrap, I know that one of the things that we talked about as we were preparing this episode is the fact that veganism as a concept can be touchy for people. I think that it has become one of those lightning rod, you know, faux culture issues that doesn't really have to be reflective of who you are. I think reasonable people can disagree on elements of anything. And one thing I think is fairly universal is that nobody likes the idea of animal suffering. Like, I think there are touch points that we can all anchor on, even if as we move down the line, reasonable people start to disagree on this or that. And certainly, you know, there's a point where I think that people can start to become emotional. I don't want to necessarily say defensive, but, you know, your emotions creep up in ways that you might not be able to immediately intellectualize, and that can become uncomfortable. And I think that's why a lot of people will shut down a conversation before it even starts around something like veganism. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you this. I'm sure you encounter this many, many times, many different ways every quarter of your life. What are your thoughts on how you can have, you know, I know what could be difficult conversations about things that you care deeply about when you're seeking to have a meeting of the mind? You're not necessarily looking to immediately change your mind, but to open a conversation and have an honest exchange.
Yeah. So I have a couple of, I used to have a couple of ground rules, and now I think I'm a little bit more flexible. I used to have this ground rule that was never yuck somebody's yum, which I also got from the Clean Food Dirty Girl community. It was kind of like a standard. But it's funny, I find that I often engage in conversations about the way I eat because meat eaters are engaging me versus me trying to engage them.
Sure.
Right? And so to me, they're conversations that are easily shut down when you go right to animal rights. I mean, it's very hard. I mean, it's impossible because it's just absolutely false to deny that animal torture and abuse is a reality of animal agriculture. That's all there is to it, right? I mean, it just is. And so I think, you know, I read up a lot on this. It matters to me. Again, this, truthfully, I made this journey for health reasons. But when you start learning about eating a whole food plant-based diet, I'll tell you it is impossible to not understand the ethical aspect of this. You cannot avoid that in your learning and reading, right? Though they are so intertwined. And so I do find most people are curious and probably are doing what they've always done and haven't taken a moment to stop and really think about it.
Yeah.
You know? And so I think just having those moments of, you know, what do you think is happening to that pig? What do you think the quality of their life is like? And does the quality of your life matter before you die? Well, the quality of any animal's life matters, you know? And it's an easy conversation to stop in its tracks, because the truth is that animal agriculture is not a pretty sight. I mean, it's just not.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially the way that we do factory farming in this country, it's abysmal. And yeah, I do think I think you can find people that simply don't care. But I don't think that you'll find anyone that's like, yes, that's exactly how I wish the system worked. If only we could make it a little bit more cruel.
Right. I mean, I think, and it's funny, I think, you know, look at how many of us in this country, you included, you're a pet owner. So many of us are pet owners, you know, and the truth is that thinking that your dogs or my cats are different than any other animal that anybody is eating is a huge, huge boatload of cognitive dissonance. It just is.
And oh, so yeah, absolutely.
It's a different level of consciousness.
Yeah, I was just reading, I'm reading this fantastic book on AI, which is probably more up your alley, but it's a great book. But one of the things they were talking about was these various tests for consciousness. And, you know, in these series of tests, like, you know, they were looking at like models and how you would value this and that. And they couldn't scale it right because there wasn't a way where pigs weren't more valuable than domestic animals and elephants weren't more valuable than humans. You know, like there's just so much, so much that we conveniently don't think about when it comes to animals and the realm, the spectrum of consciousness and intelligence. And just because we happen to be at the top of the food chain doesn't mean that we maybe deserve to be.
Right. Maybe doesn't deserve me. We deserve to be. I agree with that. And I think for me, I'm just at this point in time in my life where I would just rather be good to everyone and everything. And I look at animals as sentient beings, and I would rather be on the side of being on their side than not.
Yeah. Well, that's really beautiful. I think it's a great note to end on, Erica. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I hope that I can compel you to do it in person the next time we have the opportunity.
Yes, I would absolutely love it. Thank you so much. I so enjoyed having this conversation with you.
Me too. Take care.
You too.